Welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Scott Nye.
I am David Bax.
Thank you for listening, David.
Yes.
How are you?
Well, you know, I had pretty much, other than like promoting Battleship Pretension stuff, I've pretty much sworn off Twitter.
Okay.
But just when I think I'm out, Henry Kissinger dies.
I had a feeling when you said you had something for the top of the show that would be the topic on everyone's mind.
No, I am. It is my policy to not be happy that a person has died, unless, you know, if they had particularly wronged me specifically. Yes, maybe I might.
This ever happened where somebody who's wronged you has died and you've been happy?
I don't think I've been that wronged in my life, to be honest.
I was going
to
say,
I don't really
told stories of David Bax, if so.
Yeah, I know. But it doesn't mean I have to be sad someone died.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean I can't enjoy the jokes. And sure. I've been like so rarely on Twitter recently that it just felt, but it as soon as I got the, cause I get news alerts from politico.com, push, one of the few things I allow push alerts on my phone, push notifications on my phone for. So I'm waiting for the bus. And I'm reading something or other about some band probably. And then I get the thing. And, I went immediately to Twitter as almost like a muscle memory, just like a reflex, to see the jokes. And, didn't disappoint. There's been some good jokes.
Yeah. And here's what I'll say about the, like, being happy people are dead thing. I think there are some people for whom it is a public good for them to die. Like, I don't know that I'm like personally, I was personally happy when Antonin Scalia died, but like for that brief moment when we thought we could get someone on the Supreme Court who wasn't Antonin Scalia, I was like, good. That,
yeah, you can, I think that is something you can be happy about. If someone who is in position to do harm dies, you know what? I'm happy that they can't do the harm. I guess I'm threading a needle here, but I'm not like, I think it's okay. Just like I've always said, and I think this is something somewhere where Tyler and I have often disagreed, when Kobe Bryant died, some people were like, obviously some people were bringing up the rape accusation that he settled out of court. And then some people were saying like, how could you? And I'm like, we shouldn't start like pretending people were saints the moment they died. You know,
yeah, I think, for sure.
I think it's perfectly acceptable to bring up bad shit about people as soon as they died. You know, you and I are both fans to differing degrees, but both fans of the films of Jerry Lewis. But, when he died, I didn't feel any need to not talk about some of his sexism and his opinions on women in comedy. Doesn't mean I don't like the movies.
For sure.
You know, it's the whole person. There's a whole person there.
That's like a big reason why I wanted to like bring up the good and the bad in our big Jerry Lewis profile episode. It's like, Jean-Luc Godard profile episode, is that like there's a lot to address there. But in the case of like someone like Kissinger, who like wasn't in a necessarily position of power, but was like somebody who's regularly trotted out as like an expert in US policy or whatever else, like it's better now that we're not turning to Henry Kissinger as like a stalwart public figure, you know?
Yeah, probably.
He's gone,
not good.
That's over.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about at the top, is that Twitter still has its usefulness, even as Elon Musk is. I mean, it's funny that I check Twitter because I don't check it very often. Apparently, he also gave some interview today where he and I that I watched like a 30-second clip of that was like really cringe, really embarrassing.
Telling a room full of advertisers to go fuck themselves. So,
and like he, I don't know. He thinks he's it's like he's awful, and that's one thing, but also he's so embarrassing.
Yeah,
I'm going to, speaking of Twitter, this is like years old. A friend of me and Tyler and friend of the podcast, Jeremy Woodcock, who's an incredibly funny person, at one point tweeted something along the lines of like, The question is not whether Elon Musk is the unfunniest person alive, but whether Elon Musk is the unfunniest person possible. But yeah, so I guess, I mean, I also went to Blue Sky, but you know, you kind of catch up on all of Blue Sky pretty quickly.
Yeah,
so
doesn't have the heat for moments like this.
Yeah, so I mean, there are definitely some good jokes, and definitely some people like cross posting the same jokes on both of them.
I'm
but,
sure.
Yeah, there's it's been a lot of fun. And yeah, the world is probably a better place.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. That's all I have to say. I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. I use them each and every day of my life. Today I was listening to I've had this conversation with Natalie when it comes to black metal, and something that I think I and most black metal fans find a lot of beauty in. And I think that's maybe not like the outsider's perspective of what black metal is, but I've talked about it with Natalie because being a person who is in my car almost as often as I am, I force her to listen to a lot of music she wouldn't. As I talked about, do you see the beauty in this? And she was like, I can't remember her exact words, but it was something along the lines of, I see how someone could think it's beautiful.
Sure.
But anyway, I listened to a really beautiful album that I'm not going to say the name of because it is not in the Roman alphabet. I don't know what this says. But the band is called Misery Spell, and it's their new album, which is only 3 songs long, but is just over 45 minutes long. I listened to it today while I was at work, and I was kind of like doing the kind of like, you know, my job often requires me to like problem solve and think on my feet, but also there's just some like data entry type stuff that I have to get done. I got to fill out some spreadsheets. So I was kind of in that sort of Zen zone of filling stuff in and like listening to this on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. And it was really transportive. So the Misery Spell album that I don't know the name of has beautiful artwork on the cover too. Kind of a mix of Gothic and Art Deco. Sounded great in my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. Those are available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Scott?
Hello.
Let's get into it, shall we? Let's get into all of it. From A to Z. From go to woe, as our friends down under say. Yeah, that's an Australian saying. I once was listening to a podcast where I heard an Australian say from go to woe, and then the next time I saw Will Anderson, the Australian comedian who has been on this podcast multiple times, I asked him, I was like, do Australians say from go to woe, or is that just a thing that guy said? And he was like, no, yeah, we say that. So
I think he's fooling with you.
So
this can't be real.
Will Anderson confirms that from go to woe is an Australian saying. And now it's a Battleship Retention saying.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Bring it up every week.
What are we talking about?
Yeah, well, as we were going through, or rather as I was kind of prepping for the William Friedkin episode, and I didn't talk about this on the episode, but I reached a point where I had only one Friedkin film left to see, and I didn't end up seeing it. It was his 1994 made-for-Showtime movie Jailbreakers, which by all accounts is quite bad and would have cost me $6 to rent in SD. And so I said, nope, that is simply a bridge too far in my road to completionism on William Friedkin. But there's a part of me that was kind of like, you know, it kind of kept me wondering for a day, maybe half a day, of like, should I just do it? Should I pull the trigger? And that way I'll like have seen it all. I'll have conquered Freakin. And I was like, why is was this matter? Nobody, you know, this won't really change the arc of our appreciation of William Friedkin, but I just have this like thing in the back of my head that's like, well, then it'll just be done. And then I'd really know for sure whether or not there's not this like little avenue of Friedkin's mind that I didn't have access to. And so it just got me thinking about completionism in general. And just that is a pursuit of cinephilia. And it's just something that I see a lot of people kind of default to as a like either worthy pursuit or something they want to do, or just something that kind of drives some aspect of their movie watching. And so I thought it'd just be interesting to bat it around for an hour or so.
That reminds your should I pull the trigger on this thing reminds me, when we did our Christopher Plummer episode, I still kind of kick myself for not doing this. So there was a made for HBO movie in 1998 called Winchell, in which Stanley Tucci starred as Walter Winchell.
Okay.
And Christopher Plummer played Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and it was directed by Paul Mazursky.
All right.
And it's weirdly, it was not on HBO Max, which feels stupid. It's an HBO movie. Why isn't it on your service? But I found a used DVD for like $1.99 on Amazon, and I didn't buy it because I was like, I've got enough to watch with Christopher Plummer. But a part of me like thinks, what if that is some great, like, I like Paul Mazursky.
Yeah, that could be really good.
What if that's some great movie?
This is a tangent already, but I do get frustrated. So like Jailbreak is another example, like that could have been on Showtime's service or Paramount Plus, now that they're kind of linked up with Showtime. But there's just this like kind of like pre-2000s hole where like all those made for premium cable movies just disappeared and they're not offered at any of these services. And that's too bad because there's a lot of stuff from that period that like really never got its due because it was relegated to being a TV movie in an era before TV was kind of revered. And yeah, there's a lot of really notable filmmakers and actors who made some really interesting stuff then.
Yeah. I mean, you're reminding me one of my, I guess, white whales, maybe. Because I've said before, I have Disney Plus, and I have used it when we did like the Chadwick Boseman like profile. I used it to watch some Marvel stuff, but mostly it's that bundling Hulu, ESPN, and Disney Plus together was cheaper than just doing Hulu and ESPN separately. So that's why I have Disney Plus. But it has always bothered me that they made for the Disney Channel original movie Freaky Friday from 1995, in which Shelley Long is the mom and Gabby Hoffman is the daughter.
Right.
And it's, I think, the only Freaky Friday that is female directed. You know what? I could be wrong because I know there was a one like 2019 that another TV movie that might be female directed.
Nope.
So, yeah. 1995, there's four Freaky Fridays as far as I know.
I had no idea there were this many.
Well, there's the 70s one. There's the two theatrical ones and two made for TV ones. The 70s with Jodie Foster, and then the 2000s with Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan. There's this made for TV Disney one from the 90s. And yeah, there's a 2018 made for Disney one that has people who will probably be famous someday that I don't know who they are.
Sure.
But, yeah, directed by Melanie Mayron, this 1995 one, I don't know what else she has directed, but anyway, it bothers me. It's like, I have Disney Plus. Why is this Disney Channel original movie with stars in it?
Yeah.
Not streaming.
Anyway. Yeah, I think a big part of it is that, like, I don't know, people have this like major aversion to looking at like shitty SD transfers on streaming services. And so they probably feel like they'd have to pay to do a full like HD restoration. And I'm like, no, just put it up there. Give me something.
I mean, yeah, you would have to. Yeah, you're right. I'm with you. I would watch it. I mean, it aired on TV in 1995.
Yeah,
it was
meant to look like crap.
Standard def. But, I also, like, I don't think you have that much to lose, Disney, by going back and doing a new scan of... Well, that 1995 made-for-TV movie, it would have shot on film, right?
Probably,
yeah. So, yeah, you can go back and do a scan. That'd be great.
Get on it.
Okay, so we've already left
the topic of completionism. The point was...
Wayne Friedkin's a good example because you can be a completionist. There's some stuff that's like... I mean, I guess you can with a lot of stuff, but just looking at Christopher Plummer's resume, because I pulled it up to find that Winchell movie, like, it would be a lifelong pursuit to see everything he was ever in.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I don't think I grew the completionist like nerve because I came of age as a fan at a time when things just not being available was more common, you know, or at least like, even if not available, like it cost money, you know?
Yeah.
Like I, you know, there are a lot of bands that when I was in high school, I would have loved to have everything by, it costs money, you know? But then see, now I'm realizing that like the thing that was maybe a bad example, because the thing I am most likely to be completionist about is a band or a musical artist. Like there are artists where I have pretty much every album,
like a physical copy of it.
Yeah. Like, well, this is going to be like, hey kids, Gen Z, you're not going to believe this, because now you go to Amoeba and even a used copy of a record is going to be close to $20
all
the time. You know, I was able to get at Vintage Vinyl in St. Louis over the course of however many months, get the entire Talking Heads discography for about $3 a pop on vinyl.
Yeah.
You can't do that anymore.
I do miss vinyl being a little less fashionable. I mean, it's like, it's nice that they're still making vinyl at all, you know, for like new albums and even like reissuing old ones, stuff like that. And that's like, mm-hmm. It is cool that there's a market out there for it. But yeah, I do miss the dollar bins having better stuff in them.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I did recently come across in the dollar bin at the last bookstore. Oh my God. Now I'm drawing a blank on. We did the, or you weren't the, you weren't on it, but Aaron Neuwirth and I did a Sidney Poitier profile.
Yeah.
And what's the movie with Shelley Winters, that, like, where he like befriends the blind girl? Anyway,
oh.
It has the word blue in it.
A Patch of Blue?
A Patch of Blue, yeah. And that's, I think, I want to say it's a Jerry Goldsmith score. It's a Patch of Blue, and I found that in the dollar bin at the last bookstore, which has a great, I know it's a bookstore, but it has a great vinyl selection. I don't know if you ever go down that way.
No, I hadn't even noticed that section of but I don't go there that often.
Yeah, it's on the first floor if you just like sort of make a hard right as soon as you walk in the front door.
Okay.
It's over there.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I've seen that section. Yeah, I haven't really looked through it, but yeah, I know what you're talking about now.
Anyway,
But
yeah, I'm more likely to, but I think there's just too, like, I've said before in the big picture, I'm one of those people who like quixotically believes that I will eventually see every movie
right.
made, but that's not really being a completionist. I don't have that itch that I guess I did once upon a time with bands, and then I never really had with directors or actors.
That's interesting. Are there directors though that I'm sure there's some that incidentally you are currently complete on?
Sure, like newer directors, like,
right, yeah,
you know, but even then, like, I was gonna say Ari Aster, but like, I didn't see he made short films before he made features, so I haven't
anything. I think when people talk about completionism, they're mainly talking about like the feature work, not like seeing every music video that Spike Jonze directed or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. So there probably are some more recent ones that I just have, I've seen everything because it's been easy for me to. I guess by tradition, we're cagey about who our next profile subject is. Even though, like, if you follow me on Letterboxd, you'll probably figure it out. I believe by the time we record our next profile, I will be a completionist, but that's just because this director has a pretty short and almost entirely accessible CV.
Yeah, which is always nice. Yeah, there seems to be like a group of directors that just kind of assumed people will be complete on, like Paul Thomas Anderson kind of falls in that category. I think David Fincher to a degree. It usually feels like
Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say he feels like he's one where like usually people will have like one missing.
Yeah. With Paul Thomas Anderson, he did make like a concert film for like Sigur Rós, or what, I can't remember what the band was. He made a bunch of music videos, but he also made some sort of...
I don't remember there being a concert film. He did do like a 15-minute thing with...
No, it was Johnny Greenwood. It was 54 minutes, so it's not a... It's, yeah, Junoon.
J-U-N-U-N, oh, yeah, yeah.
From 2015.
I forgot about that, and I did see that.
Okay, so I haven't seen that. With Fincher, what would I be missing? I haven't seen The Killer yet, but like...
Yeah, before that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I'm...
I hadn't seen Alien 3 until like the week I saw The Killer. I finally saw that.
And you liked it?
I did, very much.
Yeah, I remember liking Alien 3.
But like Wes Anderson is kind of in the same group. Sofia Coppola. I think Darren Aronofsky.
Never seen Somewhere.
Man, you would love Somewhere.
I'm sure I would.
You want to borrow that anytime? It's on my shelf.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure I would. Aronofsky, there's a bunch I've skipped because I'm just not a big fan.
Yeah, I think mostly these are the ones that kind of, like, as I was kind of scrolling through my list of, like, recent films that I've liked, these were kind of the names that jumped out as ones that people usually present rankings for whenever they have a new movie out. And usually that's, a sign that people are, like, it seems like a lot of people are reasonably complete on. So then, like, the Wachowskis.
Is it just that directors who have enough films that you can rank them all in under 280 characters? Is that...
I think that's part of it, but like the Coen brothers are kind of in this group too. I mean, I haven't seen Lady Killers.
That's the only one I haven't seen too.
Let's watch it together. Let's watch it tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. That's another one where it seems like every time there's a new Coen brothers thing, which like who knows when they'll have another movie together at this point, but it feels like people are constantly ranking all their movies because it seems like most people who are kind of in our group of cinephiles have seen most, if not all of them.
But I guess that's when you're talking about directors who are like currently working and currently producing good stuff. I guess like the completionism thing means like what you were talking about with, I already forgot what it was called. Friedkin made for TV movie that you were.
Oh, Jailbreakers. Yeah.
Jailbreakers. Like having that itch of like, well, he made this movie and I haven't seen it. No one says it's good, but I have to see it to fill out the roster. Not like I'm going to see every Coen Brothers or Fincher movie, or whatever, because I think it'll be good.
You know? That's true.
I like that impulse of like, which I guess, again, with music, I used to have it more. Now I'm guilty of like, I mostly stream everything. I mean, I still buy records. Up until recently, I still buy records pretty regularly, but I definitely remember like there are Neil Young albums, that are not considered like his good albums. There's the one that's like all like doo-wop style stuff. It's just like, but I like bought those on CD, but again, like they were used and I could get them for $3 or $4, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting point about like the expectation of quality versus like just trying to see it just for a sense of like, maybe there's something interesting in it. Cause I kind of had two tiers of the directors that I could think of that I was complete on. And the second tier I put together, I thought of it as like, well, this was a little bit harder to get complete on for like reasons of availability or, mostly I was thinking about stuff like that or just mostly like accessibility, but kind of looking at the list now, there's also like these are directors who had like a big range of quality too, and like catching up on their stuff or in some cases keeping up on their stuff has meant like taking a big risk. So like the first one that came to mind was Gus Van Sant. I've seen every Gus Van Sant movie and there's a lot in there that people really don't like. I only really don't like two of them, but like I put off even Cowgirls Get the Blues forever because people said it was so bad. I ended up really liking it, but that was one that took a bit of And it has taken a bit of work to stay up on. Like seeing Sea of Trees when it first came out was like, one, just hard to do because it barely got a release. And two, I just wasn't looking forward to it because it was just so pilloried in the press. And Terrence Malick has been kind of in the same boat. You know, he kind of came back into critical favor with Hidden Life, but his post Tree of Life, pre Hidden Life stuff was so mixed review, like mostly badly reviewed. Certainly Michael Bay has been like a thing where I've been intermittently convinced I should probably just give up on, but I keep going back, mostly to Solid Rewards. And then like catching up with all the Godard stuff for our episode, there's a lot of stuff that I was like, oh God, I guess I got to slog through this.
Yeah, maybe life's just too short. But again, like I, at the same time, I still think I'm going to watch everything. I wish Letterboxd had a feature to like show you which directors you've seen, because I know it knows if I go to a director, it'll say 100%. Why can't I just show me everyone I've seen 100% on?
Well, the thing that sucks about it, so I mostly love Letterboxd, but they'll include stuff that like, I'm trying to think of a good example here. Because they don't always just have like the features on there. They'll have like sometimes commercials or music videos that are kind of like,
yeah,
besides like, the point of what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah. Miniseries often.
Yeah. And like, it, this is especially bad for actors because it'll have like every documentary they appeared in as a talking head. Right. And it's like, that's unfunctional for, or like I'm looking at Michael Bay's page right now. It doesn't include any of the work he did outside of features, of which there's been tons, but it does include a film he has not made yet.
Okay.
Yeah, and which so isn't even in production, which seems like it's unfair to list on a site like Letterboxd, which isn't like a production website. It's, you know, kind of a backwards looking thing. So even if Letterboxd had such a feature is what I'm trying to say, they it really wouldn't give you what you're looking for.
There are definitely things that like I'll be completionist with. And then, you know, what they, it's like what they say about like having a diet regimen or an eating regimen. Like if you fall off one day, just get back on the horse the next day.
Right.
I'm actually good about that with diet and exercise. I'm not good about that with like, if I miss a director's movie, then it's like, well, I guess I'm out on this. Or like, I mean, I guess even like franchises too. Like I never got around to seeing Ghost Protocol in the theater. And then I never saw another Mission Impossible movie.
Your great loss, I would say.
That's what I hear. Yeah.
I mean, franchises are trickier because there's a sense of continuity where you're like, I mean, Mission Impossible is very episodic where you could watch any of them and like basically get it. Like there's going to be small references to prior films, but nothing's too substantial. But I get that sense of things. With directors though, like if I miss one and it's the director I like, I'm still likely going to catch their next one.
Yeah, that's true. But I guess I no longer feel the urge that I have to try to. I'm trying to think, there are like some, or there's at least one coming to mind, directors that are like obscure enough that like the fact that I've seen all three of their features like is notable, and I will hopefully keep that up. So like the Alex and Andrew Smith, the brothers who made a movie you and I were talking about off mic just a couple days ago called The Slaughter Rule. I saw that when it came out, mostly because I was fascinated by the soundtrack. But then they made a movie called Winter in the Blood that played at LA Film Fest, or actually premiered at LA Film Fest, back when that used to exist. And I used to get press passes.
Yeah.
And then their last film was 2017's Walking Out, which I also saw the premiere at Sundance. So not only have I seen all three of their films theatrically, I've been at two of the three world premieres of their movies. So that like is a record that I kind of stumbled into and then realized I had. And now I'm like, okay, if the Smith Brothers make another movie, I gotta be there because that's
there you guys
I've established. Yeah.
Yeah.
And helps if they make good movies.
Sure. Yes. I mean, similarly, now I haven't seen a lot of Hong Sang-soo's earlier work, but since I've started with his stuff, I've managed to see everything he's made since 2010. And I really have the sense that like, I can't be missing stuff. And there was like a period just post pandemic where there were a couple out there that I wasn't able to see theatrically. And then I had to go back on home video. I was like, well, is this the part where I get off the train? I was like, no, I gotta keep going.
I just want to point out that before we move on from the Smith Brothers, it's because of the Smith Brothers and the movie Winter in the Blood that I already knew who Lily Gladstone was even before Certain Women.
She's
in that. It's one of my claims to fame.
Got to be Lily Gladstone complete.
Sure, yeah. But I guess, I mean, this episode could just be us like going back and forth on what are we completers about, but like, I guess I'd like to get into like the bigger questions of, is the impulse just like a nerdy thing, or is it an academic? Like, I mean that in two different ways. Like, I should have said like a geek thing, or right. Is it like an academic? Like, I will, like you were saying, I will better understand, this artist if I see it all.
I think. Yeah, for me, there's a sense always that I'll slightly be missing something on someone if I don't see the avenues. And I think it probably started as like a nerdy geek thing for me of like just wanting to like conquer it or whatever. But I think having gone through that with several directors or coming close to it or like seeing things just by dint of them having directed it, even if it's not someone I'm complete on, like, there are a bunch of Stanley Donen movies, for example, I've watched just because he directed them. Mm-hmm. And I don't always like them, but there are some that I have discovered along the way that I absolutely love that I never would have watched if not for that basic impulse. Or there's like little fascinating avenues or facets of their work that I did find in strange films. I'm looking at my list, not trying to think of a good example. Well, Howard Hawks is definitely one where like he's made like the whole gamut of like total masterpieces and some films that are just god awful, but like I don't always agree with kind of the consensus around what those are on either end. So like I watched A Song Is Born, which is a remake of Ball of Fire that he made like 7 years after Ball of Fire, and I'm not even a person who likes Ball of Fire that much. That's like kind of my big like diversion thing from most people who like Howard Hawks.
I love Ball of Fire.
I know. I've tried twice. I don't get it. I don't really find it all that funny.
It's oh my god, I'm trying. I'm so stupid. It's the screenwriter.
It's the screenwriter? Who wrote it?
That's Billy Wilder. Was like trying to like. I think that's what my guess is. That's what turns you off is that you're not a Billy Wilder fan, and it's.
It's very Wilder humor, yeah. And so I put like I wasn't looking forward at all to watching A Song Is Born because it's a remake that is not considered all that good of a movie I already don't like, but I end up really liking A Song Is Born because it's like much more Hawksian than it is Wilder. So there's a lot for me to get out of that. So I'm glad that I sought that out. But like on that same week, I think this was during COVID. I was just checking his movies out from the library. I caught up with Land of the Pharaohs, which is like his big Egyptian epic that has gotten some like notable reviews of late, and more people are kind of like, this is a really interesting movie. I didn't think it was good at all. Like I hated watching it. And like, there's almost nothing for me to get from it, but I think it, like I said, it started from kind of a nerd place. And I think there's still a part of me that is operating on that level, but I've also really enjoyed like definitely watching, well, I'm missing one on Alain René, but like, watching the bulk of his filmography, there's so much weird stuff in there that's like, it doesn't all work, but you know, you can tell this even from the masterpieces that he's constantly operating in a semi-experimental, very avant-garde and very unique way that, so even when it's not working, it's like, well, he's giving me something that I can't see anywhere else, so it's worth checking the stuff out.
Have you seen his shorts as well?
No. Well, I've seen a few of them, but not all of them.
There's a Blu-ray of five shorts that I have. I've never watched it, but I'll lend it to you after I watch it.
Yeah, I think I've seen all the ones because I remember when that came out. Okay. But I think I've seen all the ones on that disc. I'd have to double check. And I think I felt, I don't know, some of his shorts work for me. Some of them don't, as with anything else, I guess. But like a lot of the stuff he made during his shorts career was like very much of like, well, television doesn't exist yet, so we need to give something people something like a National Geographic special on a major historical figure. And like there are all kinds of theatrical shorts that are like 20 minutes long that are just kind of doing that. But then he made a movie about, I'm trying to remember which library it was. Yeah, it's just the National Library of France. That's awesome. And it's just like how libraries worked in the mid 20th century, and seeing all the like physical labor that goes into that is super cool.
So yeah, you're, real quick, what you were saying about Howard Hawks and Ball of Fire and the remake, which I've already forgotten the name of.
A Song Is Born.
A Song Is Born. I know it's come up on the podcast before. I've always wanted to do an episode on directors who remade their own movies, because there's surprising, like Hitchcock, Leo McCarey, Michael Haneke. There's a lot of people out there who remade their own movies, and it's a fascinating thing to think about. So I think that and the listeners have probably, if they've been listening long enough, probably understand that I do exhibit some like compulsive behavior.
Sure.
I am a very like structure ordered person. I let my sort of like rules and lists dictate a lot of stuff. And so you'd think that would like lend itself to completionism. And there's an alternate version of my path in life in which I am a completionist, much like, I mean, you know, who we should have had almost as a guest is your friend of mine, Kyle Anderson, who like when he gets into something, he's like, okay, I like Giallo now. I'm going to watch every single Giallo I can get my hands on.
Or yeah,
like
he does, you know,
he does all of Doctor Who, or all of the, we did a Patreon, I guess like a little over a year ago, what he was talking about, like Kamen Rider and those, and I can't remember what they're called, but like the sort of like the stuff that like Power Rangers comes from, like the big like acting that he's like gone so deep on, that kind of stuff. And so there is an alternate version of me that is like that. And I think a big revelation for me actually was getting into television.
Okay.
Because I was not like, as a kid, I watched kid shows and stuff. But as I got into middle school and definitely in high school, I was mostly like, I was a punk rocker who thought television was lame. With a few examples, with a few exceptions, I would watch like late night reruns of like Simpsons, Seinfeld, and News Radio. I would watch that. And I'd usually watch Monty Python if it was on, or on PBS or whatever, but I mostly did not watch a lot of TV. And it wasn't really until college that I like became friends with some nerds who were big Buffy fans, and the show had already been going for seasons at that point. But they would have like weekly like Buffy Angel watch parties, because those shows are back to back at the time. And I started just going, and I think kind of like realizing that television in its sort of more classical form is something that you can just jump in and out of, kind of maybe altered my brain chemistry in art, toward art in general. Like, why not treat it all like that? Now, increasingly, like, post streaming and post new golden age of TV, a lot of stuff does get treated like you have to watch all of it. Which I think that's the miniseries format. That's not what a series is supposed to be, but I think we've kind of lost that battle, unfortunately. But I think my relationship, because then I became like, I went from being like a television eschewer to being a television like connoisseur in a very short amount of time. And that lasted for about 15 years of my life, from like 2000 to 2015, and then I kind of fell off. I've been, since the pandemic, I've been getting back into like stuff that I missed over that 2015 to 2020 period, and I've kind of come to like have some more respect for TV and see that there are still some things that are done right. But anyway, this is all a very long-winded way of saying that TV broke me of my completionism or my compulsion toward that sort of thing.
It's interesting because for a lot of people, I think TV, and especially the rise of like TV on DVD, and then especially with streaming, I feel like TV's become more of a completionist thing. Because like I had friends where I was trying to get them to watch. I remember, no, I jumped in at the very end of like the run of Arrested Development, which like not the best example for a show you can kind of just jump in on, but like I had friends who refused to watch it because like, no, I got to watch it from the beginning. And even like a couple of years later, when I was getting into Scrubs, I was like, you guys want to watch some Scrubs? They're like, well, I haven't seen it from the start. It's like, who cares? You can watch Scrubs literally anytime.
No, you're right. That has become more, and I think that's part of why I've got so frustrated with television, or with the cultural conversation about television, is that that's not what I felt. That's not what I fell in love with about the medium. That like the things I fell in love with about television are the things that distinctly make it different from movies. It seems like post New Golden Age or mid New Golden Age, a lot of like movie people sort of came on board with TV, but decided to treat it like movies.
Yeah, for sure. We, Julie and I just the other night watched an episode from season one of The West Wing. The one where, Bartlett's considering, or being pressured to commute the sentence of someone who's going to get sentenced to death. And such a perfect hour of television. You can jump into it. It gives you everything you need to know to watch that episode. And
is that the one with Carl Malden?
Yes.
So do you know the Bible that he's holding in that episode is the same Bible from On the Waterfront?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
He kept it all these years, and he was like, oh, I get to play a priest again. I'm going to drag out this Bible.
Drag out this Bible. I mean, he was quite old. Maybe it was quite an effort. Who can say?
Yeah. Yeah, I had something I was going to say about that. This is not a pod. This is not an episode about television. We talked about TV last week, but I just want to make the one thing I want to make a case for is that a lot of people came on board to TV with The Sopranos, which on the one hand, it did seem to push things forward more towards the serialized thing, and that Sopranos, like, it had a memory, like everything that happened to the characters had happened to them in every future episode. But I think this idea that The Sopranos is so heavily serialized is actually kind of wrong. If you go back and watch Sopranos episodes, every one has a beginning, middle, and end. Every episode has its own story that it's telling. It's part of a bigger story, but anyway, that's just my going to bat for The Sopranos and why it's not, you know, I don't know, Game of Thrones, which I think is much more guilty of just like, here's the next hour of the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to come from adapting a novel, too. But I mean, you've seen The Sopranos many times through. Do they not do some episodes that, if they don't end with this title card, explicitly have some sense of like a to be continued?
I don't think Sopranos does cliffhangers the way that like Lost.
Because even The West Wing would do that.
Well, yeah, they'd have two parts, which is more of a network thing.
Yeah. Well, and they wouldn't even always be two parts, because I remember watching The West Wing live and like, sometimes you'd be reaching that like 55 minute mark and you're like, I don't know if they're going to wrap this up. And sure enough, you get the to be continued and it will continue the next week.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's what I mean by a two-parter.
Okay.
And then of course West Wing had, the season two finale, which, ends on a cliffhanger of, it's after Bartlett has like, announced that he has MS, you know, and they're all gaming like how to do the press conference, because you want to avoid the question of like, are you going to seek re-election? And he has a whole fucking awesome monologue where he curses God in a Catholic church, and puts out a cigarette on the floor. It's amazing, awesome episode. And then the first question, he ignores CJ's advice, and the first question is, are you going to seek re-election? And it ends before he answers. But Sopranos, Sopranos did not do cliffhangers.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. What was the point?
I guess that that, like I said, television made me learn how to appreciate art on its own, I guess, as well as part of the story.
So here's a question. You own, as do I, the Criterion On the Sparta box set, which has all of her stuff, short films and features alike. Do you suspect that, or do you in any way aim to get through all of that?
I would say anything that I own and haven't seen, I do. Like, going back to my list, that's part of my list. I don't know if I'll ever get to it, but my list of things to see include the things that I own that I haven't seen, including stuff like I have the Criterion Tiny Furniture Blu-ray, which has Creative Nonfiction in it, on his first feature on it, which I've never watched, but I do mean to get to that someday because I own it and I should watch it, and because I'm sure it's good. I tend to like her as a director.
Which tier list does this fall on?
Oh, it's way down. It's way down. Yeah. I've never actually counted the tiers on my list. Actually, that's not true. I bet I did once.
Well, no, because I don't. You have the three separate lists? Those are the tiers I was referring to.
I have more than three lists.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I have stuff I have to watch because I'm supposed to review it, even though I don't really write movie reviews that much anymore.
Right.
But I will. I'll get back to it. I have that. I have stuff I have to watch for profiles. I have stuff. I'll have a list soon for stuff I have to watch before we do our best of thing.
Yeah.
But then, after that, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lists. And the stuff that I haven't seen that I own is literally the last of the five lists. So I might never get to it. Although one of those lists is, how would you say, it's like a dead list. Like, I'm no longer adding to one of these.
Oh, sure, yeah.
No, I'm no longer adding to two of these. So I guess I do have three living lists that I still add to. And then I have two lists of stuff that I just need to get to. So that's a peek into my mind. So I might not be a completionist, but I am crazy.
Don't worry. Don't worry. There's still some insanity lurking.
Yeah.
I have a few directors that I'm frustratingly, seemingly incapable of finishing completely. I'm one shy on. So I already mentioned I'm one shy on the Coen brothers and Friedkin. I mentioned I'm one shy on Alain René. I haven't seen Knot on the Lips, which is actually one of the better distributed Alain René movies of all things. But then Tony Scott. So I haven't seen Beverly Hills Cop 2, but that's largely because I haven't seen Beverly Hills Cop 1. And so in order to get Tony Scott complete, I need to also watch Beverly Hills Cop.
I'm glad that you have that too. I was just saying that on the one hand, when it comes to TV, you drop in and out. But when it comes to franchises, I do tend to want to watch them in order.
I don't know if it's so much that I have that explicitly, but it's just that Beverly Hills Cops specifically is such a well-loved movie that to jump into the second one, which is not that well-loved, I feel like I should have the same cultural grounding that people have been going into that with.
I have a suspicion that you're not really going to like Beverly Hills Cop.
I probably won't. But
I have an affection for it, but it's really more just... it's less a Martin Brest film than it is an Eddie Murphy showcase.
Right.
You know?
Which I can sometimes feel good about, sometimes not.
Yeah, yeah. I used to be as a younger cinephile, I was more of a Joe Dante completionist, but I never went back and watched Piranha. Oh, and I guess he had one before that, too, called Hollywood Boulevard. I don't even know about that one.
Joe Dante is a frustrating one to try to get through all of them.
But as his goes on, there's more and more stuff. And then I don't know if, is the second Civil War available now? For the longest time, it wasn't available anywhere. And maybe part of my, that's part of my, I got too frustrated and I was I'm going to give up trying to be a completionist. Let's see. Second Civil War. Oh yeah. Now I can rent it. Maybe I will.
I don't even know what this is.
It was a made for TV movie but it Jonathan Rosenbaum, who is one of the like most high profile Joe Dante stands out there and has been, considered Second Civil War to be among his best films.
Oh, wow.
He sort of put together, Jonathan Rosenbaum referred to, I think it was, Second Civil War, or it would have been in order, Matinee, Second Civil War, and Small Soldiers as Joe Dante's like war trilogy, even though they're not like specifically war movies.
Yeah.
You know, I guess Second Civil War, which I haven't seen, is it's a like an alternate history type thing. But you know, Matinee is war adjacent, Cold War adjacent, and Small Soldiers is, I guess, a war.
Well, and Matinee also kind of like has the suggestion of Vietnam being on the horizon. Second Civil War, man, this has a stacked cast.
I'm seeing Dan Hedaya. Who else?
Beau Bridges, Phil Hartman, James Earl Jones, James Coburn, Elizabeth Pena, Dennis Leary, Ron Perlman, Kevin McCarthy, the good one. Kevin Dunn, Dick Miller, of course.
Of course, Dick Miller, yeah.
Roger Corman, why not?
Rance Howard, Robert Picardo, again, of course. He's in most of those. That's awesome. I gotta rent this then.
Seriously.
And
this is another HBO movie from the 90s that we should be able to stream. Come on.
Yeah. But it's yes, at least it's rentable. I forgot what I was gonna say about Joe Dante. Ah, damn it. Oh well.
Other than that, he's great, but also you look at his list of movies and you're like, do I really want to seek out Burying the X?
Yeah, that was when he started making movies like The Hole. What is it? Is it called
The Hole? Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I saw, but not in 3D, frustratingly.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. There was
But like, I mean, I haven't seen Explorers from his 80s run, but like that run from Interspace, The Burbs, Gremlins 2, Matinee. I mean, I haven't watched Small Soldiers since it came out. I should watch that again. But like,
oh, it's good. So
that might continue this run. But like that 4-film run is as good as it gets.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm also one shy on Francis Ford Coppola. The only movie I haven't seen is Finian's Rainbow. I own a copy. Haven't gotten around to it. It's like a 2.5-hour musical.
There's a bunch of his stuff I haven't seen, actually.
Yeah, that was hard to get as far as I did with him, just haven't gone all the way.
Have you seen, like, okay, if you're going to do directors, or if you're going to do, like, completionism, like, does that mean, like, if there are multiple cuts of a movie? Do you need to, like...
It depends.
With The Outsiders, have you seen the theatrical cut and, quote-unquote, the complete novel?
No. Now I can't remember which one I did see, because I rented it, and I can't remember which one the DVD came with.
I've only seen The Outsiders on VHS, so I definitely have not seen the quote-unquote complete novel, but I know there's a lot more Rob Lowe in the complete novel.
Which we all need.
I think he was the character who got cut the most out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always interested in Coppola's alternate cuts, but I haven't seen the new cut of Godfather 3. And I'm really interested in watching his new cut of Twixt, but I haven't seen the new cut of that either. And like, I'm not interested at all in watching like the like chronological Godfather cut they did for TV. Like, I'll probably never get around to that, because spend that much time on something that probably is dumb. Like, who cares? Yeah.
I used to have that on VHS and I still never watched it. I think I sold it, or I gave a lot of VHS to Tyler at one point.
Yeah.
So maybe he still has it.
Yeah. One of my big outstanding ones right now, though, the only David Lynch film I haven't seen is Inland Empire, which is very much available on Criterion Channel. Need to do it.
Yeah. I guess I've seen all of his, unless you count like, you know, Six Men Getting Sick, or like the the things that were like installation films or whatever. I haven't seen all of those, but I guess I've seen all of his movies.
Yeah, man, he has a lot of random shorts. No idea.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also good. Like, David Lynch was one of my real introductions to cinephilia after, like, I've said before that, like, Barton Fink was the movie that got me, like, seeking out movies that weren't different than what I expected. But I'm not sure where I first... Oh, wait. I was, speaking of completionism, I used to be a Smashing Pumpkins completionist. And so I bought the soundtrack to Lost Highway.
Oh, sure.
And so the, which was, so I like, so Trent Reznor had been like sort of the de facto music producer on Natural Born Killers, which is a movie that I was obsessed with, and a soundtrack album that I was obsessed with. And so like, oh, he's doing another, like sort of curating another soundtrack for this other movie, and it has a pumpkin song on it, and it turns out it's really good. So I was like, okay, I have to see this movie. And then like figuring out who David Lynch was, and like I checked out a book on David Lynch from the library, and that's when I read about like Six Men Getting Sick and all the like early shorts and stuff. So like I got on board so early that he might be one that I mean it's not that difficult to be a completionist anymore, because he's not putting out new stuff left and right, and he's not directing like the odd episode of, you know, New Girl or anything.
But what a sight that would be.
Yeah. Maybe he's one I will stay completionist with.
Yeah, there's still that rumor that he's working on something new, but we'll see.
Yeah. When did you move to Los Angeles?
2011.
Oh, okay. So yeah. So you weren't around when he did his like sort of guerrilla for your consideration campaign for Laura Dern for Inland Empire.
No, I mean, I think if I had been around, I think actually seeing Inland Empire would have been an unavoidable fact. I wouldn't have been able to skip it, but alas.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he was set up at the corner of, was it Hollywood and La Brea, maybe? Remember that Mosaic Churches, I think?
That is Hollywood La Brea, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's where he was like set up with a big sign and like a big fake cow for some reason. I don't know.
It's just typical Lynch, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, we keep getting off of the... And maybe it's because I'm a disappointment for this episode because I'm not enough of a completionist.
Well, no, you're like the counterpoint of like,
yeah,
who cares? Why does it matter? But are there directors you're passionate enough about that you feel like an absence for not having seen all of their work, either because you've heard it so good or that you do feel like there are nooks and crannies you'd like to fill out?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, and I swear I'm not saying this because you mentioned him, but Alain René is one that like the films of his that I have seen, especially Hiroshima and Marion Bad and Jatem, like especially those, are, I think, some of the greatest films I've ever seen. And so the fact that there are so many things that I haven't seen does feel like, what am I doing to myself? I'm like denying myself probably some great pleasures. But then, you know, I've seen stuff of his that, I haven't seen anything I dislike, but like Stavisky is not like,
yeah, that's tougher.
I need to go back because I have the Criterion disc. The first time I saw Muriel, which is, I've only seen it once. When I saw Muriel, I didn't warm to it that much, but I feel like there's something in it that I will love if I go back and watch it.
Yeah. Muriel's still one I'm trying to figure out. I've seen it, I think, three times, and each time I get a little closer to really digging it. But it's one that I kind of think about a fair deal. Yeah, I mean, René is interesting because he gets so far away from where he started as he goes, while still remaining as experimental. You know, his films become funnier, or at least more comedic, you would say. It's, you know, he kind of like exemplifies the stereotype of like French comedy, where it's like amusing but not quite funny sometimes.
Yeah.
But I love his later films for different reasons than I like his former ones, for sure. Or his earlier stuff. I still definitely recommend that. I mean, like, when I did a couple of years ago my 100 favorite movies as a series of double features, I paired Wild Grass with Last Year at Marion Bad, and they're like tonally very different movies, and definitely stylistically very different, but there's some kind of like kernel there that kind of made them fit together in an interesting way. Certainly like some of the character motivations are the same, but they're just attacked from a very different angle.
Another director I know you're a big fan of, what's your percentage on Rivette?
Oh, I've still got a ways to go there. Let's see. Rivette, Letterboxd, films directed by Jacques Rivette. I still need to see. Yeah, this is another one where it's like a rough Letterboxd page, because like one of his top eight is his short as part of that Lumiere and Company project that they did in the 90s, where like a bunch of directors made films kind of in the style of those early films.
That movie comes up so often that I should probably just watch it, because
I know, right? It would knock out a whole lot and really take care of a lot of Letterboxd stuff. Yeah. Well, there's a new restoration finally playing of Le Mort Fou, which is the last film he made in the 60s, which I've wanted to see for like a decade now, but has never been made available in any legal way. And even the bootleg copies look like hell. So that's playing at the Egyptian in 2 weeks. And I cannot wait for that. And I still need to see both parts of Joan the Maid, which is even by his standards, a very long film. Story of Marie and Julia, and I need to see Vos-Savoir. So there's quite a few that I need to see there. I've probably only seen like half of his features or so.
Weirdly, because when I worked at video stores, I would just take home movies every night and just watch movies.
Yeah.
So I saw Vos-Savoir when it first came out on DVD, and it made an impression on me. Like, I never forgot the movie, but not enough of an impression to like look up Rivette. And so it wasn't I was older and started getting into Rivette more and stuff that I then went back and realized, oh, that's who made that like 2 hour and 40 minute like comedy that made such an impression on me when I was 19 or whatever.
Yeah. Oh man, I feel like I had one like that, but I can't think of what it would have been. I mean, I guess like the funny answer to that is that I watched, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's Jack when I was 11 or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. There's definitely, stuff like now I'm trying to think of more examples of like, I don't know. Not that he's a great auteur, but like, I wasn't watching The Neverending Story because I was watching a Wolfgang Peterson movie at the time. I was watching it because I was a kid. That one though holds up. It might even be better. You know, sometimes there are movies that you come back to when you were a kid and they're bad. Sometimes they're still good. Sometimes they're good in different reasons. And Neverending Story, I rewatched for the first time in probably 30 plus 35 years a couple of years ago. Good movie.
I've never seen it.
And weirdly, like what's the term you've used tongue-in-cheek, like it's surprisingly like more relevant today than ever, I guess. Because like it's a fantasy story, but it's not like, and it's a fantasy adventure, but like all of the obstacles this kid faces, he defeats through his own like self-actualization and like self-esteem. And like, it's essentially like a self-care / mental health type of story.
Interesting.
Which feels much more, you know, 2020s.
Yeah.
Than 1980s. But good movie. Neverending Story.
Huh. Right on. But Rivette's definitely one that I would like to work towards being complete on. I'd love to, like I said, watch all the Stanley Donen films. I definitely intend to watch all of Ingmar Bergman's films, but I'm kind of purposefully putting some of those off as like a way to still have Ingmar Bergman movies to watch. You know, God willing, I'll live probably in another 40, 50 years. And I don't want to just take care of all of that within like, what'd it be, like 15 or so, 16?
Yeah.
Another
40, 50 years. That sounds like a curse.
I know, but
I'm not planning on being around that long.
Well, I'll keep smoking. You'll get there. Visconti, I'm close enough that I know I can get there, but also far enough that it won't just be something I'll knock out in a weekend kind of thing.
Yeah,
And Fellini's
I'm
kind of in the same
very
boat.
little distance.
I've got like 3 to 4 Fellinis to go, but I know I'll get there.
Yeah, so you definitely go deeper than I know. This came up when I think on the aforementioned Twitter we were talking about how much, like, what percentage of the they shoot pictures, don't they,
Oh yeah.
you've seen, and I'm in like the 600s, like low 600s maybe out of the 1,000, and I think you were considerably higher than that.
I'm curious myself. I mean, Visconti is just one of those guys who every film of his I've seen, they like hit me on such a personal level that I can't help but want to see more of them because it's like, you know, they're not all my favorite movies, but I'm always shocked by how resonant they are with me, like beyond just like appreciating them as cinema or as drama or whatever else. It's like these feel like a reflection of some part of me that I'm not getting from anywhere else. And Fellini's just a blast. Like every film of his I've seen is like a total gas. Yeah, I've seen 768 from the most recent They Shoot Pictures list.
Well, I'm even less than I thought, like 540. I thought I was in the 600s, but ugh.
You know, I'm only missing one in the top 50, and it's Shoah, which I really want to see, but it's like so long.
But yeah, that's lists, because I'm a list-based person, I get more excited to be completionist about maybe a list than I do about an artist.
Are there lists that you're close to complete on or complete on that you're particularly proud of?
I guess it's just my own personal list now that I think about it.
Okay.
Yeah, that I like finishing my own personal lists.
Well, if you only have like these, what lists are you talking about? You say you had these like three master lists or whatever that you're constantly
Yeah, but
working
I guess I
on.
have many, like, I like every time there's a profile episode, I make a list of like the movies I want to
Oh,
see
okay.
before we watch it, and I enjoy scratching those off the yeah, but yeah, I guess I just don't have this, but I'm not against completionism enough to be like antagonistic. It can't be your foil here.
Sure, yeah. No, I'm not asking for that. I'm just interested for the counterpoint. Yeah, Letterboxd has that section of like your stats. It's like progress on various famous lists.
Oh yeah.
And there are three movies that I have not seen on the AFI list, none of which I'm particularly enthused to see, but also feel like it's kind of dumb that I haven't seen them.
Okay, what are they?
Sophie's Choice, Yankee Doodle Dandy, and Ben-Hur.
I've never seen any of those either.
Yeah, I mean Yankee Doodle Dandy, I'll probably like because I mean literally Julie and I have talked about this. We'll throw on any Michael Curtiz movie, no matter how like random, because they seem to always deliver, and you know I'm sure it does. But like Ben-Hur's, that's what it's almost 4 hours long. Good God! And Sophie's Choice, I don't know. I run pretty hot and cold with Meryl Streep.
Yeah. Yeah, there are 12 that I haven't seen on that list.
Which
Oof.
ones?
All right, hold on. I gotta pull it
Well, the three I just mentioned.
up. Yeah. Hold on. How do I
You got to toggle fade watched.
I'm just saying not watched. Okay. Okay. This is embarrassing, some of these.
Let's hear
Oh, yeah, there's one that I'm so embarrassed
it.
to admit that I have never seen. Okay. I've never seen City Lights.
Good movie.
I've never seen The Grapes of Wrath.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a good one.
I've never seen High Noon.
Yeah, it's all right.
Okay, here's the one that everyone's gonna like unsubscribe from the
Okay.
podcast. I've never seen King Kong.
Whoa. That's just like more strange than it is like shameful, you know?
Yeah. Well, what's especially shameful is that I've seen the 70s and the 2000s King
I
Kongs. I've just never seen the original. I don't know if I was
mean,
like.
the 2000s one is just like you're watching new movies, you would have caught it. That makes sense. The
Yeah.
70s one is strange to go out of your way to see, but having not seen the original.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just waiting for the right chance, which, like, TCM Fest this year showed it,
Yeah.
but it was like Friday at 11 a.m., which is when I
Oh,
was at
sure.
work, you
Yeah.
know? Yeah. Okay. So that's four. Okay. More embarrassment to go. Never seen Midnight Cowboy. I've never seen Shane.
Shane's good. I mean, Shane's one of those movies that like every like dad movie buff is like so enthused about, and you kind of like, yeah. I don't know. I feel like I kind of write those movies off, but Shane delivers.
I've never seen Sullivan's Travels.
I do. I hate Sullivan's Travels. Actually,
I know you're not a fan of Preston Sturges.
Yeah.
I've never seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, that's so much fun.
I've never seen Swing Time.
Yeah. I mean, it's I don't know. It's tough to say. It's like the best Astaire Rogers musical, and it usually gets kind of considered that. But it's definitely a good time.
And then the three you mentioned. What are the I've seen. As far as Fred Astaire, I've seen Top Hat.
Yeah, Top Hat's the other big one.
And I've seen The Gay Divorcee. Is that both of them or is that just him?
No, that's both of them, but that's like, yeah. It was the first movie they were in and they're like only kind of side characters.
Right.
That because they weren't, either of them weren't stars yet. And they were so like eye-catching that that's the one that kind of spurred them on to be. Oh, wait, no. I'm thinking of the wrong movie. Gay Divorcee, okay. They do have kind of main roles in. I was thinking of Flying Down to Rio.
Okay.
Which they're definitely not the stars. Yeah, I'd have to rewatch some of these to remember which one I like best. But it was either... I think it was either Top Hat or Shall We Dance.
I'm wondering if maybe my like hot take is that I'm not a Fred Astaire fan.
Yeah, I kind
of... I could get some juice out of going around calling myself a not Fred Astaire fan.
I see what you mean. I mean, the thing is that like every movie of his, though, there's one, he'll do some dance number that's like unbelievable to watch. And just like, you're like, how can a human body do that? So they always at least deliver that much. But he's so like kind of whatever as an actor that it's kind of like hard to get there from there. But yeah. On the other hand, I love Ginger Rogers. So, you know, okay. That goes a long way.
Have you seen, speaking of Fred Astaire, Ruben Mamoulian's 1957 Silk Stockings, the musical remake of Ninotchka?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not great, but it has a hilarious cast. Like Peter Lorre singing is hilarious.
Yeah.
But it has Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse have a musical number and dance number about all of the sort of like mid-50s, like, theater cinematic presentation like techniques.
Yeah, that's right.
Like they're singing about like CinemaScope and Todd AO and all this stuff. It's such a strange like time capsule.
Yeah, this is what audiences knew about. They knew about all the different formats.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess like
if like the new like Mean Girls musical had a song about like Dolby Atmos.
I almost feel like I was kind of saying that like dismissively, but I almost feel like they could, because like either in the audience, there's like bros who like seek out the Dolby Theater for everything they watch. Or there's girls who know bros like that who are like sick of being dragged to the premium formats for everything and paying, you know, $25.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm, I don't know if I'm not as format, purist as you are. Definitely Natalie is like someone who like doesn't care, like the convenience is first. So like you know, she didn't come with me to see the screening of May December that you and I and Julie were all at, because she was like it'll be on Netflix in a couple weeks, and then we get from Netflix a DVD like for your consideration screener, and she was like, okay, I could just watch that. And I'm like, you keep downgrading in terms of like quality. And she's like, I don't care, whatever's like the easiest way for me to watch this movie I want to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's depending on how soon she watches it, you know, the streaming option would be easier to queue up, but yeah, no, I'm not,
as
not
as
like
as this recording, it's not streaming yet.
Well, yeah. I'm not a format guy necessarily. Like, really, the size of the screen kind of matters more to me.
Okay.
Than anything else. Because, like, I just saw the new Hunger Games movie today, which I was like, I didn't really care about at all. And then the trailer looked kind of interesting. And then it got, like, surprisingly good reviews. And so I ended up checking it out. I never really liking it, but I almost didn't see it because it's going to, like, the smaller kind of shoebox theaters in the next week or so. And I was like, you know, big action movie spectacle thing. I really, really want to see if it's on a good screen. But I definitely don't shell out for the like Dolby stuff. And IMAX is only if it's like something like Oppenheimer, where like you really got to make the effort.
So you said you liked the Ballad of Snakes and Songbirds?
Yeah.
I'm curious. I was not curious at all, because I think I was more of a Hunger Games. I've only read the first book and it wasn't very good. I was more of a fan of the movies than you were, I think, going up to the last one. But I think you and I both were very unimpressed with that last, with Mockingjay Part 2.
I sometimes note that as the worst movie I've ever seen. It was certainly the one where watching it, I most regretted being in the theater.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And so I wasn't that interested, but I don't think I realized that that Francis Lawrence is back as director.
Yeah.
And him, even though he made Mockingjay Part 2, which I don't like, he's a director that I am almost a glitch on. I think Water for Elephants is the only one of his films that I haven't seen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't make that many. He made Constantine, which I'm a big fan of, and that's another one that I've sent, like, been vindicated on over time. More and more people have come around to Constantine is cool as shit. And then I Am Legend, which, you know, we've litigated so much on this podcast. I think Water for Elephants is the only one I haven't seen.
Well, I just now learning he had a hidden Netflix movie last year.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Never mind. What was it called?
Slumberland.
Yeah, that's right. Jason Momoa.
This is literally the first I've heard of this movie.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. Oh, well. I guess I was off anyway. We should wrap up because we're way off. Okay, first off, what is your favorite Hunger Games movie?
Definitely this new one, by a considerable degree. Yeah.
Okay. Because the only one that I've ever returned to and watched more than once is Catching Fire, the second one. The first one that Francis Lawrence did, which I really liked.
Yeah, that one's the most like a movie. And so I do like it the most of that original quadrilogy. Yeah. But this one's a considerable step up from all that.
Okay. And then because we talk about directors, what is the franchise, not necessarily that you're completest on, but that you've seen the most movies from? It's easy to be like a completionist of something that has like three movies, but like how many James Bond movies have you seen, or how many Saw movies or Friday the 13th movies?
Yeah, because necessarily this is going to tend towards something that's had a ton of entries. I've seen 11 James Bond movies, which is more than I would have guessed.
I think I've seen 8 off the top of my head.
So Bond might take it just by dint of there being that many. Like, my instinct was going to be that it would have been Star Wars, because I've seen 9, and like I didn't think I'd seen that many James Bond movies. But I can't think of another franchise that's had more than 11 entries that I would have been able to see more than that.
Yeah, I guess not. Yeah.
And I should say, for the Star Wars fans possibly yelling at this, I know there was the animated film, The Clone Wars, and nobody cares.
And then you're also not counting like Solo and Rogue One, which you also saw.
Oh, that's so true. So
that takes you to 11 there.
And then wasn't there another? The only of those two spinoffs, maybe.
I think there were more that were planned that kept getting scrapped.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there were just those two. That makes 11. So that's the most I've seen then, because I've seen all of those Star Wars movies. Yeah. Slasher franchises, I don't go very deep at all. I've seen I've seen 3 Halloween movies, 1 Friday the 13th, 1 Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, I kind of tap out at the first of most of those movies. I mean, I did mention
4 Screams. I saw all the Wes Craven Screams.
Yeah, I want to watch more Screams, having now seen the first two. Really loved them.
Well, the third, I mean, I don't know. I know it has its defenders, but I think the third is the least of them, and I think that has to do with the absence of Kevin Williamson. He didn't write that one, but they reteamed for Scream 4, which I feel like people were so primed to dismiss when it came out.
I did feel that in the water,
but I thought it was good. Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything I would have seen more than 11 of. Because, yeah, I said eight James Bonds, but obviously there are eight Harry Potter movies, and I saw all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, 11 Star Wars.
Well, unless did you go deep on the Fantastic Beasts movies?
Oh, no, I forget about those. Yeah.
Yeah, as do we all. Yeah, I saw the first of that one, tapped out after that. But then again, I never saw the first two Harry Potter movies, so
Oh, really?
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, David Yates, like, weird, like, he had a promising career. He came into Harry Potter and started making good movies.
Yeah.
And then after Harry Potter, he made the one Tarzan movie that was fine. And then I guess he just went back to the Harry Potter world?
Well, and
Or
then
has he?
he made Pain Hustlers this year,
Oh, okay.
which is apparently awful.
Ah, that's too bad. That's a
Yeah.
shame. You hate to hear that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a very loose episode, but that's fine.
Hey, that's all right.
Thank you for listening. You can do, of course, email us at david@battleshipretention.com or tyler@battleshipretention.com. Follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, especially if you have some good jokes about Kissinger, at Davey Pretension. Check out my other podcast. It's called The One Where I Met Your Mother. Watch with my do with my wife. And yeah, Scott, where do you want people to track you down on the internet?
Yeah, Twitter and Blue Sky at Rail of Tomorrow, Letterboxed, just posted a review there. I'm particularly proud of, or not a review, but just a couple thoughts on Oppenheimer that I never really got down because I caught a screening of that this week and really loved that movie all over again and kind of forgot that I hadn't written anything about it. So I threw some notes up there about that. And then got reviews up at Battleship Retention. I need to finish writing my review of Lesson Duckalist, which is the new
Okay.
Isabelle Huppert movie that was quite good. And I feel like I just reviewed something else that was coming out. Oh, the new John Woo movie, which is bad.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah.
I
Oh, and
didn't see it,
I
but yeah.
did post a review I'm pretty fond of for the new Criterion 4K, sorry, UHD release of
Thank you.
Last Picture Show in Texasville. That was I really enjoyed going through those again and writing about them.
Oh, okay. Before we end, I thought of another thing I'm almost a completionist
Okay.
on, because we talked about this actually on the Patreon. Yeah, sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/battleshipretention. Our friends Jim Rohner and James McCormick do a podcast where they talk about movies that are based on or inspired by H.P. Lovecraft stories.
Right.
And I have become the go-to guy for adaptations of Dreams in the Witch House. So I think I've seen every adaptation of Dreams in the Witch House that is called Dreams in the Witch House. There is an earlier adaptation that they changed the name that I haven't seen. But other than that, I've seen all of them, both TV and movies.
All right.
All
You
right.
talk about having
So,
a weird corner of the market
yeah.
completely taken care of.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening.
And we'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.